This is United States v. Brito, 17-5033. Would counsel for appellant make his appearance?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. William Glasser for the United States. In Snyder, this Court held that a Johnson-based Section 2255 claim must fail where the District Court's ACCA determination at the time of sentencing rested on the enumerated offenses clause rather than the residual clause. In light of Snyder, the District Court erred in this case by granting Section 2255 relief. The District Court's first error was in concluding that where the record is silent as to which clause the Court relied upon, the defendant carries no burden of showing that he was, in fact, sentenced under the residual clause. In Snyder, this Court did not actually address the burden because in Snyder, the finding was to the contrary. However, the 11th Circuit decided that issue in Beeman, and this did so consistently with the Supreme Court's precedent and this Court's precedent with respect to who bears the burden of showing entitlement to a relief on collateral review. The Supreme Court has long held, going back to Hawk v. Olson in 1945, that the petitioner bears the burden of showing entitlement to relief on collateral review. That means in this case that Mr. Brito was the party that had to show that he was sentenced under the residual clause as opposed to the enumerated offenses clause.
Well, can I ask you a question about that? Because we have this cross-reference to the Hamilton opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the district court's opinion in this case. And in the Hamilton opinion, if I'm recalling correctly, the judge said that the defendant or the movement there, Mr. Hamilton, actually did meet the burden. In other words, said he didn't have to, but even if he did need to meet the burden, he did. And then a lot of Hamilton is incorporated by reference.
Correct.
In this case, is that part of Hamilton incorporated by reference as to Mr. Brito?
Your Honor, from what I can tell, it is. In this case, specifically on page 58 of the appendix, the court concluded that it most likely relied on the residual clause. However, it said that after incorporating by reference the Hamilton analysis, and in Hamilton, the court said that although it did not have a specific memory as to which clause it relied upon, it concluded that it most likely took the path of least resistance.
Well, okay, but what I'm getting at, though, is if the court said in Hamilton that Mr. Hamilton, as movement, had showed reliance on the residual clause, does it follow that Mr. Brito did? And if that's the case, does this burden issue even matter at this point?
Your Honor, and perhaps I'm misunderstanding the question, but I do think that the burden matters, and for two reasons. The government's primary contention is that regardless of who bears the burden, the case law at the time shows that the district court would not have relied on the residual clause. But I do think that the burden is important in sort of another step, because in the Hamilton opinion that the court incorporated in this case, the court first decided that there is no burden for the party seeking relief, and then concluded that even if he bore some burden, he satisfied it. The government's contention is that both of those conclusions are incorrect with respect to Hamilton and with respect to Mr. Brito.
And that's the point. I think, at least as I understood Judge Matheson, what he's asking is, at least you read the court in this case as having as incorporating the point that the burden has been satisfied by Mr. Brito.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That's our understanding, is that the court, with respect to Mr. Brito, I think it's fair to say, the court concluded that he did not bear the burden, but even if he did, he satisfied it.
Okay. Let me just ask a standard review question. Both you and Mr. Brito's counsel will frame the issue in terms of the clearly erroneous standard, and I was a little curious about that because it seems to me that you could say that this really is a mixed question of law and fact, given what Snyder says about the fact that although there's a finding, the reality is that a large part of what's going on here is a legal component.
That's correct, Your Honor, and in retrospect, perhaps we should have argued that a higher standard than clear error applied. It's a close and difficult question, however, because as this court noted in Snyder, relying on the Ninth Circuit's Giozzo's opinion, this is sort of an unusual circumstance where in some cases it's certainly possible that the district court will have a recollection that, generally speaking, he relied on the residual clause in certain sentencing decisions.
But that's a question of historical fact, and I can correct. See that that would be under the clearly erroneous standard. But I guess what I'm saying is that it seems to me it's a little more complicated than that because you have a determination as it relates to the relevant legal background that we have in Snyder, and I assume that we would review that de novo. Isn't that
your That opinion? Is correct, Your Honor. And so, again, in retrospect, it's possible that the government should have argued for a higher standard of review. We think we can still satisfy even the clearly erroneous standard. And the reason is, again, if we said, for example, that the district court had a specific recollection in this case, that he relied on the residual clause as opposed to the enumerated offenses clause, Mr. Brito still would not be able to bear his burden of showing entitlement to relief in light of the relevant case law. And I think that is an appropriate legal determination for this court to make. In other words, at the time, at most, the district court, consistent with this court's law, could have concluded that there were two alternative bases for sentencing Mr. Brito under the Armed Career Criminal Act. In other words, it would have been plainly erroneous at the time for the district court to conclude that the enumerated offenses clause could not possibly be at play, because under this court's en banc decision in Hill and subsequent cases, it was very clear that Oklahoma second-degree burglary, when it was burglary of a building, was treated as falling under the enumerated offenses clause.
Oh, let me follow up there then. Are you saying that if, and that's not this case, but if the court had an actual factual recollection that it had relied on the residual clause, why wouldn't that, in this case, in the conversation, because in your brief, you've waived any sort of harmless error argument, so the question really is, did the court rely on it or not, full stop, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think Snyder somewhat changes the analysis, and again, I don't believe that our brief actually waived a harmless error
There's
analysis.
There's a footnote in it that said we're not relying on it in this case and we're pursuing it in Hamilton. I can pull it out.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's in there.
And certainly that is, but I think that's a second step. The harmless error is a second step beyond the Snyder analysis. And the Snyder analysis is you first have to show that you were sentenced, not just that you were sentenced under the residual clause, but in fact that you were sentenced on an unconstitutional basis. In other words, that you were sentenced under the residual clause and only the residual clause.
Well, wait a minute. An unconstitutional basis goes to why isn't that harmless error? Why aren't you conflating the issue? Because it seems to me the initial question is, and that's the one in this case, based upon that footnote, the only issue we have in this case is did the court rely upon the residual clause or not, right?
Your Honor, that is correct with one caveat. I think that in Snyder, this court said that it didn't specifically say this, but indicated that it needs to be more than just relied on the residual clause, but in fact relied on the residual clause to the exclusion of the enumerated offenses clause.
Well, the court didn't, if I recall correctly, there was no memory in Snyder as to which one the court relied on, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if this court, I won't pursue this much longer
sure.
since it's not this case, but if this court had said, I know what I relied on. I relied on the residual clause, nothing else.
Your Honor, if the
That's
court...
That's it, right, for this case.
Your Honor, I certainly understand that would be one reasonable interpretation of this case. I do think, though, that Snyder goes a step further and says that the district court would have had to have concluded that, in other words, that it would have been, the defendant would not have satisfied his burden under Snyder if the district court had said, I relied on the residual clause to the exclusion of the enumerated offenses clause. And the reason for that is that would have been plainly erroneous under this court's case law at the time.
Why would it have been plainly erroneous? It's my understanding that at this time, the residual clause was a question mark. Even under your briefing, the residual clause was not decided. We didn't have Johnson, so why would it have been plainly erroneous to rely on that?
It wouldn't have been plainly erroneous to rely on the residual clause, but it would have been plainly erroneous to conclude that the enumerated offenses clause did not apply.
Those are two different questions.
Correct.
One can say that I'm relying on the residual clause. I don't need to reach the enumerated offenses clause. That's not saying it doesn't apply. It's just saying I don't need to do it.
Yes, Your Honor. And it would certainly be a closer question if the district court had, as in the hypothetical we've posited, if the district court had concluded that it relied on the residual clause and did not reach the enumerated offenses clause. But bringing us back to this case, the district court simply did not do that.
And let's bring it back to this case. Let's talk about path of least resistance and your argument with respect to that, please.
Yes. So the path of least resistance at the time, and in fact what all of the cases that reached this court did, concluded that the enumerated offenses clause applied to Oklahoma second-degree burglary, applying the modified categorical approach. The modified categorical approach obviously requires introduction of Shepherd documents. That didn't happen in this case, but there was also the defendant did not challenge in this case that he was an armed career criminal.
But doesn't the fact that there was no consideration of Shepherd documents and really no modified categorical approach analysis at sentencing indicate that at least with respect to this sentencing court, the path of least resistance was actually the residual clause?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't for a few reasons. First of all, again, because he did not contest his armed career criminal status, the government did not need to introduce the Shepherd documents, but the PSR specifically indicated that this was burglary of a residence, in other words, burglary of a building. He was charged, in fact, with first-degree burglary, which requires it to be of a dwelling. So it just wasn't disputed, and that was
common practice not to introduce the documents if the facts essentially would have met.
Yes, Your Honor, it's common practice. Now subsequent case
then.
Subsequent case law might indicate it's still better practice to introduce them anyway. Mm-hmm. But the point is that at the time, there were many cases that had come to this court that had all concluded that second-degree burglary in Oklahoma, where it involved burglary of a building, fell within the enumerated offenses clauses, full stop, no need to go anywhere else. And if we look at the flip side of the coin, could this have fallen under the residual clause? That would have actually involved a fairly complex legal analysis. First of all, determining whether the offense as a whole, which includes breaking into unoccupied vehicles, and even a subsequent part of the statute involves breaking into to vending machines, whether that categorically violated the residual clause. In other words, categorically, whether or not that would have been something that posed a risk of injury to a person. That would have been a complex analysis that this court had never undertaken. And in fact, there was no case law indicating that Oklahoma second-degree burglary would have fallen under the residual clause. So the path of least resistance, in light of this court's unanimous case law involving the enumerated offenses clause, was to use that clause and not the residual clause. If the court has no further questions.
Could I just to make sure I'm understanding your position, it seems as if the case for you rises and falls on whether the sentencing court relied on the residual clause.
Correct, Your Honor.
And if we disagree with that, then the case is over because you're not relying on harmless error.
That's correct, Your Honor, because we forfeited the Mathis divisibility argument in this case. I'll reserve my time, if I may.
Sure.
May it please the Court, I am Barry Derryberry, appearing on behalf of Mr. Brito. I do think the burden of proof is a critical question and should be the first thing we address. My brief identifies the burden of proof as it has been. I'm sorry, I should say the standard review. I misspoke. The standard review as the general rule that applies on appellate review of 2255 cases. If we go through Snyder characterizes, as I think Judge Holmes had said, the district court's finding as to what clause was relied on in that sentencing as historical fact. And so we have that, and then a characterization in Snyder of that to answer that historical fact, it may be necessary to inquire into the snapshot of what the law was at the time of the sentencing.
And surely the snapshot is not reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard, is it?
Well, certainly if the district court in evaluating that snapshot makes an error in assessing the law, this court has to correct that. But if we begin that this is within a historical fact being found by the district court, and I'd say, too, you know, it can be a matter in some cases, this is a broad question about what the standard is. In some cases, there could be questions of were there Shepherd documents evaluated. I mean, there could be cases in which it is chiefly a factual inquiry by the district court.
There could be. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but there could be. But the bottom line is that this is a mixed question, is it not? I mean, there's the one question, did I rely or did I not? as a matter of historical fact. Do I remember whether I relied or do I not? But Snyder complicates this because then that's not enough, really. I mean, at least we have to take a glance at what the legal terrain was at the time, right?
Right.
And that glance is going to be determined, our assessment of what that legal terrain is, has to be a de novo issue, isn't it?
I distinguish this kind of case with the historical fact evaluation, distinguish that from a case that comes to this court where this court says, okay, look at what we have now. We have maybe Shepherd documents. We're looking at what is the provision in the ACCA that applies. No doubt that's a mixed question, and de novo review is applicable to that as a case that comes before this court.
But to the assessment of what the snapshot is, that our assessment of what the snapshot is a de novo review question, isn't it?
It's difficult for me to answer that because I know of no case.
It's a pretty straightforward question. Is it a matter of law or not?
I don't think that it is purely a matter of law. I think that this court would find that it would be clearly erroneous if the district court made a misassessment of what the prevailing law was at the time.
And we would only get at whether it was clearly erroneous by doing a de novo interpretation of what the law is, right?
Clearly erroneous and de novo, I see as two different standards.
They are two different standards. My point is, you can have something can be clearly erroneous because the court's determination of the law. Well, if this is a legal question, do you accept the premise that legal questions are reviewed de novo?
Pure legal questions, yes.
Okay. And is the snapshot of what the law was at the time of the defendant's sentencing, is that a pure legal question?
No, not, because it is in a context, and it's in the context of a historical question.
Okay.
And so what I struggle with is I can't think of any other type of issue where this court has clear error review. And inside of that, embedded that, is a subpart or a step embedded inside that's de novo.
Well, whether we've done it or not, it seems to me doesn't change the fact that we have to decide what to do with it. And it seems to me that I guess the example I would give is when we're determining plain error, okay, part of that plain error assessment, of course, depends on what the law is. Well, plain error standards as a law as it exists at the time of the appeal. But in part of determining plain error, we look at what the law was at the time that the court made its decision, too. And the point there is we're going to do that de novo, aren't we?
Yes.
And why isn't that the same sort of thing that's going on when we're determining what the snapshot is?
I cannot tell where one leaves off and the other begins.
Okay, I don't want to eat up all your time on this.
It's
question.
Okay.
Well, it's applied to this case. Maybe give us your position on what the legal background was at the time of sentencing. What was the legal background?
The legal background is provided in quite a large part by the Hill case cited in both of the briefs, both sides' briefs in this case. An en banc decision by Judge Baldock, which addresses a conviction of burglary, a prior conviction of burglary, comparing it to Taylor and finding that it's overbroad. And Hill says that if it is overbroad, then the categorical approach to finding that it is an ACCA predicate is unavailable. It cannot be found categorically, which I think is true for this case. There's no way that the court could have easily found categorically that the prior conviction qualified. Notwithstanding the number of cases that opposing counsel is citing, I don't think that those are cases which are inconsistent with Hill.
All right. I guess the reason I wanted to hear that is you've given us your interpretation of Hill at that time. We've got to look at Hill if we look at the legal background at that time. I'm just not sure how to reconcile that with a clearly erroneous standard. It's a matter of looking at the case and trying to determine what it said. How can How can you reconcile that with a standard review that really goes to findings of fact?
There's a hybrid aspect to this, which I wrestle with as to provide an answer because I know what the court is seeking. Certainly, this court has to make sure and right heard that the district court is accurate as to the law. Does that necessarily convert everything to de novo review? I just say that we have to be mindful that in the next case, it may not have so much to do with the law, the snapshot. It may be the fight is over historical records, and so is there de novo suddenly then going on? Is that reconcilable with the general standard review for 2255 cases that come before the
court? Well, why can't it just be a mixed standard? I mean, it doesn't seem to me it's difficult to recognize that whether I decide, whether in my mind I recall that I ruled under the residual clause, I'm making a finding I did. I don't see any reason we can't review that for clearly erroneous and then look at what the law was under de novo. Why is that, what's so complicated about that?
I don't think it's that complicated. Okay. And clearly erroneous review implies a measure of deference. And why, this court wouldn't defer to a lower court's finding of what this court's precedents mean.
Well, to that point, why should we defer to the district? Well, putting it another way, why is the district court's view that the path of least resistance was the residual clause? Why does that square with the snapshot of the law that existed at that time?
Well, the snapshot is not the only thing that is applicable. It's a snapshot of law is not the only thing the district court is looking at. I think probably real close to when Shepard came out, but Hill discusses the same concept, borrowing from what Taylor says. Hill, Umbach, says that the court can look at the records and makes the distinction that there does not need to be a transcript of the plea colloquy. It can be a judgment and an information can suffice for what the court takes a look at.
But nobody was looking at records here, were they?
No, and that's part of the landscape, which is because nobody was looking at records, that indicates to the district court that modified categorical analysis was not undertaken at the time of sentencing in 2005.
If all of the legal landscape, and I'm sure you'll correct me, but if all the legal landscape is pointing in the direction of applying of the enumerated offense portion of the statute, if all, in the sense that that's a settled issue, that's done, we know what the answer is there. And in order for the court to do something else, it has to engage in a new analysis. If you juxtapose those two, why is engaging in the new analysis the path of least resistance?
Because Hill predated the sentencing in this case, and Hill says that if you have, and it's for Oklahoma and other states that have the overbroad burglaries, it's not all states, if that is the case, then you cannot categorically determine the answer.
I understand, but isn't that in the context of somebody challenging it, somebody making it an issue that has to be resolved? In this case, it wasn't an issue that had to be resolved,
right? It may be in that context, but it does not have to be in that context.
The
court has to be satisfied. If the court had any doubts, without a doubt, it was sua sponte inquire. In fact, we've had it happen in Northern District of Oklahoma where a court said, I need some records. Go get me some records.
That may be, yes, that may happen. But the reality is that in this case, in the PSR, were recited the facts that would have supported the result under that this was a generic burglary. Now, unless the court had a reason to go behind the PSR, which it could in some instances, that did it as long as it wasn't objected to, right?
That's not the correct way through. I think Snyder has the answer to this, which is...
Okay, give me, what is Snyder's
answer? Snyder says that in looking at what the historical facts are in light of the snapshot, the district court can as well rely on what the PSR says in terms of modified categorical analysis if the PSR has relied on court records. And so it said broadly or generally that the court records of the state prior conviction can be taken into account. And then Snyder says that is precisely what happened here. The PSR took into account court records. And so we understand this in the context of being Shepherd documents, of course, what those court records are. And we know that police reports, discovery, that kind of thing, are not fair for consideration. In this PSR, there is no indication that the citation of facts, recitation of facts, was sourced in any court records. There's no identification of what records they came from. And I'd also, this is very critical, too, for me to point out that oftentimes PSRs do rely on information, charging documents. This defendant was charged in the state case, which is in the appendix, with first-degree burglary, but he pled to second-degree burglary. And there is no information or amended information alleging second-degree burglary. And so one cannot actually even say, well, look at these records. They would have naturally come to the conclusion that you put the information and the judgment of conviction together, and now we know what our elements are because of the first-degree versus second-degree amendment to the charge here.
Isn't it the case, getting out of this unique context, isn't it the case as a general matter at a sentencing that if the defendant does not object to the factual recitations of the PSR, that the court is able to accept them as fact?
For purposes of the sentencing guidelines?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, for purposes of sentencing, period. And so, that being the case, there are factual recitations in the PSR. Nobody's objecting to them. Why can't the court say, okay, that's the landscape, that's the factual landscape, now let me rule?
Because our marching orders under Hill en banc is that...
Well, didn't the Hill defendant challenge this? Challenge the sentencing? Challenge the ACCA enhancement?
I believe he did.
Okay. Well, that's not this case then, is it?
No, it's not. But I don't think I've seen a case that says failure to challenge the basis of ACCA does invalidates the application of the limitation of Shepherd documents to particular types of documents.
Could you address Mr. Glasser's argument based on Snyder that, if I'm understanding it correctly, that for you to prevail, the sentencing court must have relied exclusively on the residual clause? In other words, it isn't a matter of both of them maybe supporting the sentence, but it's just the residual clause. Could you address that?
May I answer?
Yes, please.
The way I'm understanding this issue is that, for instance, Beeman says that the defendant has to show more likely than not. This is the government's pet case, 11th Circuit, more likely than not that there was reliance on the residual clause. And that is what the district court found, that he likely, path of least resistance is just another way of saying, and the court says at two different points in its orders, that it likely relied on the residual clause at the time of sentencing. And so to say that a defendant also has to prove that the enumerated offense clause was inapplicable goes beyond that burden of proof. And I don't think any circuit has said that the burden of proof is higher than more likely than not or preponderance.
Isn't that exactly what happened in Snyder, though? Both clauses were possibilities. The residual clause is certainly a possible alternative, but the court nevertheless said you've got to go through the analysis, you've got to look at the legal landscape at the time, and that landscape showed, in that case as it does here, seems to here.
Right.
It didn't talk about the burden, but impliedly it seems to say if there's two options, you know, the residual clause is the least likely option here. Does that make sense?
Right. But I think again, under Hill, categorical analysis was not an option because of the overbreadth of Oklahoma burglary, Section 1435. And there's no sign that modified categorical was undertaken. So it's a dead stop, to quote somebody. Full stop.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, just a few brief points on rebuttal. First of all, with respect to the standard of review, this Court has an independent duty to determine the appropriate standard of review, and to the extent the government attempted to carry a heavier burden than it needed to, I think this Court can conclude that de novo review applies, at least to a component of this case, regardless of the government's decision. The only situations in which the party's decision to argue for a standard of review can be determinative is where the party actually bears a higher burden, such as bearing the burden of showing plain error and failing to even attempt to satisfy that burden. I think this Court's decisions in Richardson and Devon establish that. But this is the opposite situation. With respect to the background legal environment, Mr. Brito cites Hill for the proposition that his offense would not have fallen within the enumerated offenses clause. And it is true that Hill concluded that Oklahoma second-degree burglary is not categorically a violent felony. However, Hill and the cases we cited following Hill all concluded that applying the modified categorical approach, which is not a complicated analysis that occurs in many cases, that applying that approach, the burglary of a building did fall within the enumerated offenses clause. To the contrary, the residual clause was something that had never been in play in this circuit. And in fact, after briefing in this case, I attempted to find any case in any circuit that had determined that any burglary statute fell within the residual clause as opposed to the enumerated offenses clause. And the only one that I found, and I apologize, it's not cited in the brief, but there is a case named Mayer from the Ninth Circuit, which involves Oregon first-degree burglary, which was a very different situation. The court there concluded it did fall within the residual clause. But the Oregon burglary statute in that case involved being armed with a dangerous weapon or causing or attempting to cause serious bodily injury in the commission of the burglary. So that
we properly have that as part of the record in this case, could you just give us a supplemental authority letter on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm happy to do that. But that's the only case that I could find that had concluded that any burglary statute in the country fell within the residual clause. There was no similar case law with respect to Oklahoma second-degree burglary, and the only authority that the district court had to look at the time established that applying the modified categorical approach, it would fall within the enumerated offenses clause.
Can you address his question or his argument about he argues that the PSR here, unlike in Snyder, didn't refer back to the actual court records?
Your Honor, It's true that it didn't refer back to the court records, but I don't think that that's determinative. Again, because the facts in the PSR were undisputed, the underlying bases for those facts simply weren't an issue. If they had been disputed, then the government would have had to come forward with the records to support them.
Thank you. Case is submitted.